people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Greetings, Toronto. You're listening to CHRY 105.5. And this is your Monday night show at 8 o'clock, Radio Basics, the radio wing of Basics Community News Service. My name is Steve, and I'm here with my co-host tonight.
Kirti,
how are you doing tonight?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. So, you got a big show for us tonight. It's been almost a year since the tragic, devastating, but also politically outrageous situation that unfolded in Haiti in the earthquake and its aftermath. What do you have for us on the show tonight?
That's right, actually. We're going to have... Well, this whole segment is dedicated to Haiti, and we're basically going to be interviewing Kevin Edmonds, basically mm-hmm. from Toronto Haiti Action Network. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the usual thing, I guess.
All right. And you got headlines for us today?
Definitely, I do.
All right. Take it away.
So, another possible attack on working-class Torontonians was announced today as TTC might be looking at a fare hike effective February 1st. So, what we're looking at is basically a 10-cent increase to TTC tokens from $2.50 to $2.60, and a $5 increase to monthly passes from $121 to $126. And TTC has said that all routes will continue to receive bus services, but 48 bus routes will see a decrease in bus services during late nights, weekends, mm-hmm. and off-peak hours. I wonder which bus routes they are, most likely through the working class neighborhoods. Yep. And for all the keeners out there, the TTC board has announced a public meeting this coming Wednesday in regards to the proposed operating budget, which I don't know the location.
Yes, Toronto's wonderful, but completely vacuous and empty consultations where
definitely
they can
yes.
say that, well, we had a public meeting and
no
people had their chance
yes,
to
yeah.
fill out some papers that mm-hmm. when we divided people into small groups, then collected their paper and we did absolutely nothing with it.
Pretty much. Yeah. This, you know, you got that right. And next, City of Toronto looks at further expanding the current police state as more taxpayers' money is expected to go into the policing budget. So the requested budget for 2011 is $26.7 million, which is an increase from 3% compared to last year. Additionally, the amount budgeted for overtime pay is in 2011 is $43.1 million. But keep in mind that this amount does not include any new hires or pay increases that is yet to be negotiated with the police union. And if there are any increases in pay, which has historically been an increase of 3%, it would be an additional $30 million. On top of that, if Ford's promise of hiring 100 new recruits take place this year, then that would add another $10 million to the budget. This is just a little run-through of the expected policing budget, and all this mm-hmm. is happening as 5% cuts are being made to all city departments this year. I when I came across this information, I couldn't believe it.
Well, surprise, surprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
While the G20 leaders were announcing their age of austerity, their era of austerity, mm-hmm. protected behind an army of police officers from all levels of state, mm-hmm. It's no surprise that the police are the only service that is not going to be cut. In fact, will be getting an increase to their pay to a sector that is not only inflated, but also... You know, also cops are paid quite handsomely for
definitely,
beating people's
yeah.
skulls in at,
for sure.
at G20 summits.
It's very sad and unfortunate. Anyways, besides all that negative news, I guess, some good news for Palestine as Chile has adopted a resolution recognizing Palestine as an independent and sovereign state, adding themselves to the list with Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. Uruguay and Paraguay are expected to follow these South American countries quite shortly. So that's kind of exciting.
It is exciting, but it's hopefully Chile will follow its own lead and soon begin to recognize the rights of its own indigenous people, the Mapuche people, because they had a nominally, progressive, socialist government in power up until the latest elections that happened, where a very right-wing government came to power. Mm-hmm. They were extremely repressive and continue to be extremely repressive of the country's indigenous population, which most Chilean people can actually trace some degree of their own heritage to the Mapuche people. So good on the international level, but if it's just showcasing for diplomacy, they got to apply that right to self-determination to their own people as well.
That is so true. And you had something for us, right?
Yes, also in international news. After day two and a week of referendum elections in southern Sudan, one of the most oil-rich and certainly the largest country in Africa now faces division as a vote on secession has been put to the south. Western countries have been placing pressure on Sudan since the 1990s to capitulate to Western economic and political interests. The United States has supported armed groups in Darfur and southern Sudan, which, in the case of the South, waged two decades of armed struggle against the Sudanese government. In 2005, as part of the peace process, the South was guaranteed a referendum on secession in 2011. The government of Sudan has maintained a foreign policy that is independent of the United States and has brokered many trade deals with China. Sudanese President al-Bashir's resistance to U.S. bullying has led to the International Criminal Court slapping him with genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes charges. In July 2009, the member states of the African Union agreed not to cooperate in facilitating his arrest. Meanwhile, genocidal African heads of state and some responsible for millions of deaths, such as Rwanda's Paul Kagame, who, may I add, is handsomely rewarded by the West for his support for their policies in Central Africa. The likes of Kagame, meanwhile, have never been charged or faced charges of crimes against humanity or genocide for their atrocious activities. If the South secedes, southern Sudan will become one of the most economically underdeveloped regions of Africa. Clearly, with close political ties to U.S. interests, the South will turn to the United States and international financial institutions to invest in the exploitation of the South's resources, which, if one traces the development of the civil war, or I should say civil wars, in Sudan, one can find the contention of different imperialist powers, contemporaneously United States and China, investing in Sudan in different ways in order to gain control over the strategic resources that lie within the country, a country that is the largest in Africa, and if united and developed, has the potential to lead the entire continent in economic development. If countries like Sudan, Kenya, Nigeria, and Egypt alone, for instance, were economically united and developed their own trading bloc like Latin America is doing with ALBA or other such somewhat more progressive trade arrangements, those four countries alone can lead the whole continent in development. I should have added the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, to that. But these countries, however, remain divided by fratricidal civil wars because of the interests of imperialism, because of the funding to groups by the imperialists in order to divide and break up the country. And also in the news, Paul Kagame's Rwanda, in response to the current secession vote that's taking place in Sudan, has began calling for a secession vote in the, I think it's the province of Kivu, or around where Lake Kivu is in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I don't know if I'm quite surprised about that.
Yeah, see, Kagame and his army and his proxies in that region of DRC have been waging and helping support wage civil war in the Congo that has led to the death of at least 5 million people. And finally, some agencies within the United Nations are beginning to bring some pressure upon Paul Kagame for his war crimes and genocidal policies. But I think this is only beginning to happen now, because after 15 years of Paul Kagame, after the period of what's called the Rwandan genocide, although the whole last 20 years in that part of Africa has been a genocide, you know, led by imperialism. Now the UN is, I think, wanting to back away from Paul Kagame because he has been, and the government of Rwanda has been most definitely one of the most human rights abusing genocidal forces since Second World War. And, you know, the blood of Central African people is all over the hands of all those who who greet Paul Kagame, who bring Paul Kagame to George Bush's ranch in, in Texas and so on and so forth.
I hope that's not all on paper, though.
What's that?
I just hope that's not all on paper.
What do you mean?
With the UN?
Yeah, well, I think they're wanting to back away now from Paul Kagame because it delegitimizes them. For 15 years, it has delegitimized them. The fact that they speak about human rights abuses in one place or another, yet you have 6 million people dead in the Congo. And very little is said, and you know, Paul Kagame is allowed to act with impunity. So on the topic of Sudan, you know, over the next couple of weeks, here on Radio Basics and at basicsnews.ca, which is our main website, we'll be providing some more in-depth analysis to this secession vote in Sudan. There's already signs of violence. The Western media has provided a lot of very positive coverage to the secession vote, suggesting that you know, it's absolutely guaranteed that the South will vote yes. However, there are reports to suggest otherwise, and if this secession vote does not succeed, it'll therefore appear like in the Western press that it was undermined or it was fraudulent or it was undemocratic or whatever the case may be. In any case, the reason the likes of Jimmy Carter, former president, former presidential candidate John Kerry, and George Clooney, the reason they are in Sudan right now is to promote American imperialism. So let's have our eye on Sudan for the coming weeks. Any more headlines?
No, that's about it, I guess.
All right, so let's go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with
Kevin Edmonds
from Toronto Haiti Action Committee. Radio Basics.
2CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at CHRY.FM. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics. We're back.
Okay, so today's segment, as I mentioned, is dedicated to Haiti as Haiti commemorates their first year anniversary after the devastating earthquake on January 12, 2010, which killed 230,000, injured 330,000, and basically made millions homeless. 2010 was definitely a rough year for Haitians as they were affected by the earthquake, the hurricane, cholera, which was introduced by the UN occupying forces, and according to official figures, that killed 3,500 people and it infected about 150,000, if not more. And then plus the political unrest and violence during the election fiasco. I would also like to mention that it's important not to victimize Haiti and acknowledge their history of resistance during slavery, and also acknowledge that they are currently under the imperialist occupation of the United Nations, United States, Canada, and France, and after the coup d'etat in 2004. So basically, Haiti is in its current situation due to many external agendas and imperialist interests that doesn't necessarily uphold the Haitians' well-being. Well, today we will be interviewing Kevin Edmonds. Kevin is a freelance journalist, member of the Toronto Haiti Action Committee, and a graduate student from McMaster University's Globalization Institute. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Chrissy.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. So, Kevin, can you please tell us more about the work that you do as a freelance journalist and your involvement with the Toronto Haiti Action Committee?
Sure. Well, I became interested in Haiti after the 2004 coup, which removed Aristide from power the second time. And what he was trying to do was implement what I would say most intelligent and moral people would consider to be a progressive government that looked after the needs of the poor majority. So I began doing a lot of research and reading about Haiti. And after the earthquake and seeing all the tragedy unfolded, I decided I'd try and publish some material. And surprisingly, I was accepted by alternative media, and that has opened the door. And I've been able to get some articles published by the mainstream press as well. So the journalism sort of led me getting into contact with organizations such as the Toronto Haiti Action Committee. And I met some great people like Niraj, who are basically the heart and soul of the organization in Toronto. I mostly write articles and try and do some advocacy that sort of highlights the need for the international community to respect the Haitian people's right to self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
So through the journalism, I've been able to make a lot of contacts, and I was invited down to Haiti to cover the elections on November 28th with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. I worked with them on a report which highlighted the irregularities and the fraud which was going on in the lead up to the elections and was unfortunately ignored. And it did highlight, you know, that it would lead to political unrest, that the Haitian people wouldn't accept an election that excluded 15 political parties. Mm-hmm. And also the most popular and progressive party on the, like, most popular and progressive party, which was Jean-Bertrand Aristide's Family Lavalas party.
Okay. So we'll definitely talk a bit more about that a little later on, but I wanted to ask you, in March 2010, soon after the earthquake, leaders from around the world gathered in New York for a donors conference, pledging about $6 billion in aid for 2010 and 2011. But according to the Office of the UN Special Envoy for Haiti, only 63.6% of the money pledged for 2010 was actually dispersed. And some countries have broken their promises, sending less than 1% of the amount they pledged to spend on aid. Taking into consideration the current realities, such as displacement, lack of proper sanitation, clean water, and so on, what is being done actively in order to get these pledges, and who is in charge? And more importantly, how is the money being used, and how is foreign aid really helping Haiti?
Well, that's a great question. I think that it would be too easy and misleading to say that NGOs haven't helped anyone in Haiti, especially after the earthquake.
Okay.
They're on the ground feeding people, treating the sick, and providing services for many people. But I think the bigger question is that why are there so many NGOs on the ground in Haiti? And I think a bigger thing that people that are interested in Haiti and want to understand the situation is that we need to understand that, you know, these NGOs on the ground are the result of international undermining of Haiti, mm-hmm. especially the Haitian government's attempts to build basic social services. And NGOs are the result of, you know, going around the Haitian government and their attempts to build public services and putting the money into the hands of private organizations. So if you look at a lot of the stories that have been coming out, especially this week in out of Haiti, they're sort of saying, you know, the reconstruction effort has largely failed, but they're not really going into any detail to explain why. Like I said before, the past 20 years, sort of NGOs have been popping up all over Haiti as a way to circumvent the international, circumvent the Haitian government. And really a cycle of blame, because the international community uses the presence of so many NGOs in Haiti as a sign of their, you know, failure as a government, when in reality they engineered that situation. And you can see that aid today in Haiti has been a way to control or punish Haiti, and that's something that's mm-hmm. historically been the case for a while.
Okay.
And sorry, what you just brought up about the $6 billion, actually the New York conference, $10 billion was pledged.
Oh, okay.
But most of it's being held back until government is established in Haiti, and the government that the international community wants is one that will be friendly to, you know, their investment opportunities and basically rubber stamp their development plans. So the biggest thing is that their NGOs are unelectable and they're unaccountable. And they're also run as businesses. So
what do you mean by that? they want a government that would, you know, why is the funding and the aid being held back? What kind of government are they looking for? What kind of government have they been trying to engineer since the 2004 overthrow of the democratic government of John Bertrand Aristide?
Well, the biggest thing that Aristide did, which was, you know, remarkable in Haiti considering the resources that he had to work with, was to build schools, to build universities, and to build hospitals, and to try and move the Haitian people out of misery into what he called dignified poverty, and just trying to be like reverse the trend which was undermining the Haitian people's ability to you know, look after themselves and to stop becoming dependent on handouts. So Aristide and Lavalas were basically been off the map in regards to organized electoral politics in Haiti since 2004 because of their agenda, which was to put the poor majority at the forefront. And I think that with so much money on the line, the 2004 coup happened, you know, there was not $10 billion on the line, and Aristide at that point was looked at as a threat because he was going to try and develop, you know, progressive you know, state services for the people, very basic, but at the same time he was trying to do something that, you know, was going against the ideology that's promoted by the IMF, the World Bank, that's always trying to deal with privatization and liberalization. So
So, like Steve mentioned, in 2004, then-President John Bertrand Aristide was overthrown and kidnapped by Canadian, U.S., and French troops. The coup d'etat was followed by the introduction of the U.N. occupying forces and the establishment of a puppet government, which was supposedly democratically elected, and had President René Préval in charge. Now, like you mentioned, you were in Haiti last year during the elections. What was the socio-political climate like, and what was going through Haitians' minds? And can you briefly reflect on that experience?
Yeah, sure. To be totally honest, I was going out in the camps with the organization that invited me down, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and they're an advocacy wing of a Haitian grassroots organization called the BAI, the Bureau of Advocates International. And they took me to a lot of the camps where they do their organizing. Mm-hmm. And when we talked with people in the camps, to be completely honest, elections weren't on the minds of the people we discussed, especially like in their flawed form, where, you know, they couldn't vote for Aristide or 14 other political parties. So people expressed their frustration that, you know, the international community was putting a lot of money into what they saw as a flawed political process, because people were literally dropping dead in the street from cholera. And that's not an exaggeration, because on the day of the election, when we were walking around to polling stations to see, you know, to try and monitor the situation, there was a corpse of a cholera victim about 30 feet away from the entrance to a polling station. So while people were going in to cast their vote, they sort of stopped and said, you know, they're putting $30 million into these elections. And, you know, this lady had, you know, passed away because she couldn't get access to medical treatment. So they're saying, like, the priorities are in the wrong place, that they shouldn't be giving money to, you know, hold rigged elections. People want medical care. They want security in the camps. You know, they want basic services to be provided. 1.5 million people are still homeless. A lot of camps on the outskirts of the city, they're actually being bulldozed because the landowners want their land back. They're saying that the camps are damaging their land because there's poor sanitation. There's a camp, Camp Immaculate in City Soleil, which was home to 200 people, that was literally bulldozed while the people were in their tents. So
where are they being relocated?
They were never, we were never given any information where they were relocated. Probably most of the people will be living in the streets because there's not much alternatives for the people that are there. So, you know, on the ground, the people that did see the election as a way to get services ended up being denied, because when we were at the polling stations, a lot of people were turned away. And I met a lot of people on the street that also said, you know, they don't want to vote because They can't vote for who they want to. You know, people said they wanted to vote for Aristide, but overwhelmingly, the people said they wanted to vote in a democratic election, and that wasn't taking place. So,
why were people being turned away?
Well, the organization of the election was actually Election Canada helped to fund the elections that just went on, and it was really, really disorganized. And not just, it's on the point where we concluded that it was intentional, because you couldn't have such a level of, you know, negligence that caused so many people to be turned away. I was part of a group that altogether we visited 50 polling stations throughout Port-au-Prince, and we all witnessed people being turned away because the voting registers did not have their names on them. We talked to people that would go up to try and find their name on the voting register and see their neighbors or their family members that had been killed on the earthquake eligible to vote, but themselves were unable to vote because...
Now, some people may think that, okay, well, you know, Haiti's in shambles, it's in a difficult situation, maybe this level of chaos is understandable. But, you know, if you compare, I know I followed closely the last elections, the ones that brought René Préval to the presidency, and I remember some comparisons being done at that point between those elections, which were also organized by Elections Canada, funded by the Canadian government, and the elections that had taken place in 2000 that had brought Aristide to power with an overwhelming popular support majority. I think 93% of the electorate voted him in. And just comparing those two elections, I believe that the number of polling stations, as well as the number of people who actually voted in the latter, the ones that the Canadians organized, was a mere fraction, and that people couldn't get to polling stations. They were so far away, people's names weren't on lists. So it sounds like this history repeating itself.
Right, right, because I talked to people that, there were some people that literally walked to six or seven polling stations. Like, some people really wanted to vote, and they were denied. A lot of people didn't want to vote, and we actually went to one polling station that did not receive any ballots for the entire day. So... people were told to go and line up outside this school. Lycée Pierre Fritz, just in central Port-au-Prince, and the people were turned away because there was no ballots for them. We went there at 11 a.m., just 5 hours into the voting process, and the ballots hadn't been delivered yet. And then we came back again around 2:30, and the same thing had happened. And our colleagues had also reported the same thing at stations across, you know, the city.
So I'm kind of curious to know, so you said that $30 million was allocated for the elections, right?
Right.
Where did that money go if it was so disorganized and people were not able to vote and they were being turned away? Where did all this money go? Do you know?
To be honest, I'd say like probably most of it went to security, because everywhere that we went, there was a heavy presence of the Haitian National Police. There was a heavy presence of MINUSTAH, the stabilization, well, so-called stabilization mission in Haiti. Yeah, the UN. And they set up tents. They had a lot of volunteers that were on the spot. I'm sure most of them weren't being paid. I don't know where the money went. They printed lots of ballots, but they were at the wrong places. They printed voter lists, but they had the wrong people on them. It just seems like they were trying to engineer the election so that, you know, René Préval's successor, Jude Celestin, would have been, you know, the man that takes over power and sort of would ensure smooth continuation, whereby, you know, the international community can undertake their projects in Haiti without much, you know, disruption, and get, like, they would have a sense of legitimacy.
Now, just to provide a bit more context for our audience, despite Préval being the more popular of the candidates elected in the last election, he became very unpopular quite quickly in his term as president, right?
Right, because he was elected on a very progressive, you know, platform. He was saying he was basically going to continue the policies of Aristide. The people couldn't vote for Lavalas, but they saw Préval as an extension because he was the former prime minister. So he promised the Haitian people that, yes, he will continue to build schools, build hospitals and try and redirect the funds to help the poor majority in Haiti. But as soon as he got into power, you could see that he was sort of backsliding. He was making more agreements. He was you know, taking part in more privatization, opening Haiti up to foreign business, which at the same time sounds good to most people. You know, what's wrong with jobs? But there were sweatshops where he didn't raise the minimum wage. There was a huge call around the nation for the Haitian daily minimum wage to be raised to $5 a day. And Preval said, okay, I'll do that, except for the people that work in the sweatshops, which was, you know, most of the...
A large chunk of the labor force, right?
Right. The direct investment that was coming into Haiti was to go towards these sweatshops.
Yeah.
And he says, no, I'm going to keep them at $3 a day. So you can imagine people living on $3 a day. If they have children, they have to send them to school. You know, they have to buy food, that they, you know, provide transportation to get to work. By the time they spend those $3, it's time to go to work again. You know, it just keeps you alive. It doesn't let you build a house that would survive
So
the earthquake.
So it seems like the so-called international community really got what they wanted with Preval. They got the face or a face of Lavalas, but they didn't have Lavalas. The Femme Lavalas party was crushed. Most of its cadre were underground. They were dead. They were in jail. They were in exile. The movement was not allowed to participate in the elections. And so it was the illusion of the old progressive popular regime without any of its base, which was being beat back and held back by the United Nations forces and the police forces.
Right, right. That's exactly what happened. And in Haiti, the elections, it's been happening so that they give the appearance of legitimacy, because even Preval was elected sort of as a last resort.
Yeah.
And the people just gave him enough legitimacy that he would be able to take office. And I think now that they've seen that happen, that's a consistent pattern. They sort of gave up. And we're hearing that this election, that the votes are being recounted under the, you know, the eyes of the Organization of American States and CARICOM. But they're not releasing the results of the election. That was supposed to come out on December 20th. And they keep postponing it. So this is about two weeks later, and nothing's happened yet, or 3 weeks later, and we just keep hearing reports from the Center for Economic Policy, and they're saying that, you know, they're finding, 160,000 votes were actually turned up during the recount, you know, which should invalidate the process, but nothing is happening.
Yeah.
The international community is trying to keep it on the low and just sort of force it through the Haitian people, and I think that the mainstream media in Canada as well is doing a good job trying to convey that, because there was a an article in the Globe and Mail sort of a couple of days ago saying that we have to force the Haitians to accept the results of the election. You know, and we're there trying to bring democracy, and we punish them for being corrupt, but we undermine them at every opportunity that we get. So
the narrative of good governments, which is a kind of a fig leaf for imperialism, that, you know, oh, we're just trying to provide good governments to African countries who are corrupt, and we're in there to help. But the popular and the democratic government was overthrown 6-7 years ago, right?
Right, yeah.
So you spent some time in Haiti. You know, you were there for the elections. You got to see the country and the capital, Port-au-Prince. So you can, you know, figuratively speaking, you had your hand on the pulse of the people for a minute. What is the political situation in Haiti right now? What are, you know, it seems like the people are being blackmailed. They're being told if they don't accept this government that they don't support, they're not going to get the aid that's going to come down, but the aid that's going to come down is going to benefit, you know, the foreign companies and development for, not for the Haitian people, but for the elite and for the foreign corporations. So what is the political mood of the people? Where do they see Haiti going from here?
That's a really good question. When I talked to people, they wanted to choose a party that fit their interests. And, you know, vast majority of Haitian people, unfortunately, they live lives of poverty. Within Port-au-Prince, like 1.5 million people are still living without shelter. So these people, they want very concrete things. They don't want promises of, you know, jobs far away, yeah, or, you know, investment that won't touch them. They want real concrete things. They want water. They want security. They want shelter. And the people's previous experience showed them that Lavalas was the political party that did that. And, you know, if they're taken off the political map in regards to elections, a lot of people are becoming, well, at least in this election, they were becoming apathetic to elections, and they're just saying, you know, forget it, that we're trying to, you know, vote for who we want, and at every corner, you know, they're sort of taking away our option, and they're forcing us to vote for people that we don't want, and then, you know, if things go wrong, they'll be punished for it. So it's really, really a tricky situation. But what I did see was that a lot of Haitian grassroots organizations were doing things on their own. That groups like the BAI or Kofa Vive, which was a group of Haitian rape victims in the camps, like, they're getting together and they're saying, you know, we can't rely on the international community to come in and, you know, help us, because they know that that's not the case, that they know that, you know, development is very self-serving, and they're going out, they're organizing the communities. And I think that this is leading to, you know, maybe a further radicalization of Haitian politics, where, you know, where people are going to take the situation into their own hands, not through a violent way, but just through grassroots organization, because they can see that, you know, the avenue of democracy, which is promoted by the international community, is not meant to serve the Haitian people. So,
Sure. And just to bounce off that, like, so clearly this conversation led to the fact that all these kind of decisions are being made in the international arena for Haiti. But to what extent are Haitians or their government being involved, if any at all? And what kind of agenda are these decisions reflecting?
Well, yeah, Haiti right now is basically a protectorate of the international community. And the Haitian people pretty much have no say in the decision-making process. And on December 14th, the Haitian members of the Interim Reconstruction Committee, which is led by Bill Clinton, which is a body supposed to designate where the aid goes and what the priorities should be, they actually released a letter saying that, you know, they've been completely sidelined within that body, that they're totally disconnected from the decision-making process. And even at some of the most important meetings, they were even denied seats. They didn't have seats set up for them, so they couldn't take part at the table, literally, to determine the future of their own country. And when the Haitian people hear this, they take to the streets, they express their frustration. But, you know, they're demonized by the press, they're demonized by the United Nations as, you know, people rioting, and they just want to cause trouble and throw stones at the troops, when, you know, in reality, they're expressing legitimate, you know, frustration, because the United Nations is there supposedly to help them. They bring cholera. The international community is there supposedly to help restore democracy, but, you know, we stage false elections to undermine it. You know, we're there to help them develop economically, but we're, like, enforcing more neoliberal policies. We're robbing the Haitian people of their self-determination, and telling the Haitian people to step aside because, you know, these foreign experts know best. But anyone that knows the history of Haiti, as you mentioned in the opening of the show, you know, they're largely responsible for most of the problems that Haiti have today, in regards to dismantling of the Haitian agricultural sector, the undermining of public health and education by structural adjustment programs. Also, the Aristide administration operated under aid embargoes, which robbed them of a lot of funds that would have gone to build water and sanitation services. You know, and this is just a continuation. The Haitian people have a you know, legitimate reason to be wary of, like, foreign aid and the presence in their country, because it's never really worked in the favor of the Haitian people. So
it's basically not responsive to what people really need, like I mentioned. It's just not, it's, you know, catering to the agenda of imperialist forces and so on. So thank you so much for joining us, Kevin. We are kind of strapped up in time right now, so unfortunately we can't fully continue the conversation. But is there a website or anything that we can, our listeners can possibly visit to get more information on this?
Well, they could look at the Toronto-Haiti Action Committee, and they could also look at the Canada-Haiti Action Committee. And if I could just have 1 second to say something. On Friday, January 14th, the Toronto-Haiti Action Committee is going to be holding a fundraiser to help actually legit Haitian grassroots NGO called SOPUDEP.
Sorry, what are they called?
SOPUDEP, S-O-P-U-D-E-P.
Yep.
It's an amazing organization which provides education and community services for some of the poorest people in Port-au-Prince. Mm-hmm. And they do this without taking any overhead for administrative costs. You know, everything that you give in goes to the Haitian people. So it's an amazing cause.
That's wonderful. Where will the event be happening?
It's going to be happening at U of T at the William Dew Auditorium. Mm-hmm. And you could find information on that on the Toronto-Haiti Action Committee website. Mm-hmm. It'll be at 6:30 on January 14th. And it's $20 for general admission and $10 for students. And you can go online to uftix.ca to get your ticket.
And is it a speaking event or a dinner? Or what's
right, it's going to be a speaking event. And the director of SOPUDEP, which is the community school, Rhea Dole, she's going to be there, and she directs a whole bunch of programs to school, but also as microcredit programs, HIV prevention, and does a lot to help people in like very difficult situations. So it's a really amazing fundraiser, and if people want to see how grassroots organizations can bring about change, you know, it's a good opportunity to support.
Okay, thank you so much for that announcement. We'll probably re-announce that towards the end of the show.
Okay.
And thank you so much for joining us today and providing us more insight about Haiti.
No problem. Thanks for the opportunity.
Have a good
Thanks
night.
A lot.
Take care.
That was Kevin Edmonds of the Toronto Haiti Action Committee, who recently came from Haiti. He was there for the elections. He's an investigative journalist based out of Toronto. This is Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. We're going to go to a break, and we'll be right back.
5.5 FM.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM.
Haiti has been, of course, put upon by outside powers for its whole post-slavery history. We'll come to ask the question, why? What happened? And who's had a hand in it? If Haiti has been under a series of serial dictatorship, who armed the dictators?
What end wage slavery in rich nations? Dinner parties at Forest Hill as Haitians. 200 years ago, they broke from slave ships. Overcome Napoleon's guns under slave whips. Haiti's occupied by U.S. replacing. Democratically elected Aristide Macon. Changes like Manly's PNP Jamaicans. When they unified with Cuba built relations. Led to a regime change. CIA agents. Reagan in 83 occupied Grenada. Now they built 7 military bases waiting in Colombia to strike Venezuela hating. Chavez bought Russian war planes for the day when the U.S. white ruling class hit the stage with more rage than the April Cooper oil changes. He armed civilians for the war like Mao in Asia. Read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions. Read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions. Read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions. Read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions. Golden shower on the rich, young ones take the grade. From PE, political education pays for read and study lessons, reawaken slaves, build leadership with the Venezuela mind frame at the Benjamin Richmond Peace and Justice Academy, inspired by Antonio Gramsci, the strategy. Battle ideas in bourgeois civil society with my comrades, even though the state's eyeing me. Babies can't eat steak, movements build gradually. Babies only eat cake, they will grow cavities. Time will tell if the streets stop acting street to prepare the fleet. Attack, then retreat. Read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions.
study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions, read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions, read and study lessons, read and study lessons, debate and study, take notes and ask questions.
9 countries in Latin America have voted in the president who said no more exploitation by foreign corporations. These presidents have said the profits from Ecuador's oil must benefit Ecuador's poorest people. The profits from Bolivia's gas must benefit Bolivia's poorest people. Every one of these countries was run by a brutal dictator, a Washington puppet. Not anymore.
There you have it. That's Wasson, Study Lessons on the topic of Haiti. Study your lessons, study Haiti history. Look back 206 years, almost to the day when the Haitian Revolution rocked the world of slavery and colonialism, for which that small but mighty nation has been punished ever since. We are speaking to Kevin Edmonds on Radio Basics tonight. And you can check out basicsnews.ca for some feature analyses from Kevin Edmonds, an article he published on our website called Haiti 1 Year Later, Misery Loves Companies, and in parentheses, NGOs. Haiti has been the topic of our conversation tonight, as well as Sudan a little bit earlier in the show. In a couple weeks' time, maybe next week, maybe the week after, I'm not sure, we're going to be having some more analyses looking at Sudan and how imperialism has divided and racked that country with civil war over the last 20 years. Just to wrap up our show for today, we're going to go out with a couple of community announcements. First, we want to announce Rebel Diaz, Brooklyn-based hip-hop group, Chilean, and two Chilean brothers and a Puerto Rican sister who constitute Rebel Diaz. They're going to be here in Toronto January 20th, Lula Lounge, 1585 Dunnett Street West. That show is hosted by Barrio Nuevo and yours truly, Basics Community News Service, also sponsored by United Food and Commercial Workers. And Voces Latinas, Kirti, I forgot to turn your mic on. What's up, sister?
I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, it's going to be dope. We have Code Blue, Salvadorian rappers from here in Toronto, La Bomba, who was on our show with us late last year in 2010, Chilean sister, rapper, melodic, Jamaican reggae artist, grew up in Toronto, produced out of Brooklyn for a while. Our very own Revolutionary Love, also known as Makaya, who is also a host here on Radio Basics.
That's right.
And Toronto's Spin, Guatemalan brother, well known for his spoken word poetry. So that's going to be January 20th, 10 p.m., Lula Lounge, 1585 Dundas Street West. And I believe it's $10 in advance, $15 at the door. And you can get tickets at the Toronto Woman's Bookstore, which is at 73 Harbert Street. Second event we have coming up, also a Basics sponsored event, is a book launch of Defying the Tomb, which is a compilation of prison letters and essays, as well as some semi-biographical essays from Kevin Rashid Johnson, who is the Minister of Defense of the New African Black Panther Party, which is a revolutionary black organization based out of the prisons in the United States, not only fighting the incredibly torturous and repressive conditions in America's prisons, but struggling to unite new African, or that is black or new African people, as well as other working class people in America for revolutionary social change. And we're going to be featuring his book here in Toronto. It'll be launched on Thursday, January 27th at Beit Zeytoun, which is a small spot on Markham Street by Bathurst and Bloor, 612 Markham Street. That's January 27th. We have a set of speakers and discussion followed by a hip-hop show and an after party. You can get more information on that as well at basicsnews.ca. Kirti, you had an event for us as well?
It's not necessarily an event. It's actually something also that's connected to Haiti. One of the sisters that I know, Melinda Francis, aka Docu Vixen, is actually doing a fundraiser. She herself mm-hmm. and a team of other artists are actually planning on documenting a lot of these stories out of Haiti, mm-hmm. and they want to get down there. It's basically a Haiti community film project, and they actually just want to get down there and try to document all these stories that are not necessarily being, you know, heard by us. And I would just say, you know, if you're interested in, you know, making a donation or anything, just email her at walnutstudiosloft@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. That's walnutstudiosloft@gmail.com. And get in touch with her and find out more about the project. It looks like a really exciting project, but we just need to, you know, just mindfully put in some funds in there so that, you know, like community filmmakers like her mm-hmm. can actually get down there and do the job yeah. that,
it's you know. Like, incredibly important for Canadians to see what our government mm-hmm. And the companies that our government, you know, defends and supports has been doing to the incredibly dignified, heroic people in Haiti.
For sure.
And also just to remind our listeners that, you know, we're talking to an investigative journalist based out of Toronto, associated with Toronto Haiti Action Committee. They're going to be having an event on Friday, January 14th. That's, I guess, this Friday, supporting a grassroots, truly, truly grassroots organization in Haiti, Sopodep, which provides education to children in Port-au-Prince. I believe he said the director of Sopodep will be in Toronto speaking. She'll be speaking. I don't recall the sister's name, but it'll be $20 and $10 for students, 6:30 p.m., William Dew Auditorium. That's at the University of Toronto. And we probably have time for at least one track, maybe two. We'll see. But what are we going to drop? You want to do this Young Artist for Haiti track? What do you say?
I mean, sure. We can maybe talk about that, because I think if you're going to play that, we have to talk about it.
No doubt. So
sure.
While we're on the topic of Haiti, and, you know, this is certainly a song that, millions of people have heard, maybe tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions, certainly mm-hmm. probably
most of
Canadians for this was Waving Flag, which the whole world now knows thanks to the World Cup and Kanan becoming a superstar based on that song. But then this, you know, after the earthquake, this song was taken up by many Canadian artists. It was Young Artists for Haiti covered Waving Flag themselves, and, you know, imputed their own ideas about Haiti into that song. However, ideas of which are influenced by, you know, the mainstream media's mm-hmm. conception on what's going on in Haiti. Now that, you know, our listeners, hopefully, who have been with us for the whole show, have been listening to the radio interview that we had here today, talking about the dictatorship, the military occupation, I should say, the kidnapping of the presidency, the blackmailing of Haiti by withholding aid. You know, people mm-hmm. got to listen to the lyrics in that context.
Yeah, yeah. It's totally off.
You know, like, when, what is it for a country to grow up? You know, whose flag is being waved here? Just check out the lyrics. Think about that. If we have some time, we'll be back. And if not, mm-hmm. Radio Basics, you know where to find us every Monday night here in CHOY 105.5. For now, yeah, that's it. I'm Steve.
Kirti.
And we'll check you next week. Peace.
Take care.
Started out as my song, but then it became their song, all of these artists' song. And now it's really going to be Haiti's song.
Broke all my dreams, now feels like defeat, to wretched return. wait for things to break apart. If you weren't involved before, it's never too late to start. You probably think that it's too far to even have to care. Well, take a look at where you live. What if it happened there? You have to know the urge to make a change lies within, and we can be the reason that they see their flag rise again.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag.
And then it goes back,
and then it goes.